This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Escape Artist, written by Brad Meltzer, read by Scott Brick and January Lavoie.
1898. John Elbert Wilkie, a friend of Harry Houdini, was put in charge of the United States Secret Service. Wilkie was a fan of Houdini and did his own tricks himself. It is the only time in history that a magician was in control of the Secret Service. Prologue. Copper Center, Alaska. These were the last 32 seconds of her life. As the small plane, a twin-engine CASA used by the military, took off from the airfield, most of the seven passengers on board were staring out their windows, thinking themselves lucky. Few people got to see this side of the world, much less the private base that the Army had built out here. On maps, it didn't exist. On Google, it was permanently blurred. In the last row of the plane, a woman with shoulder-length black hair was convinced she was blessed, marveling at the snow-dusted tops of Alaska's beautiful aspen trees. She loved that the roots of aspen trees often grew together, supporting each other and forming a giant organism. It was why she joined the Army all those years ago, to build something stronger with others. She got just that when she came out here to the lush wilderness. Definitely blessed, she told herself. Then, just like that, the plane began to vibrate. Her initial reaction was, fix it, straighten us out. She was annoyed that the vibrations were messing up her handwriting. On the open tray table, she was trying to write a letter, a dirty note to her fiancé, Anthony, telling him what she was planning to do to him later that evening. Her hope was to slip it into his back pocket, Anthony being so surprised and horny from her traveling all the way to Fort Campbell on his birthday, he wouldn't notice her sliding some playful fun into his pocket. And even if he did, well, thanks to their army schedules, she and Anthony hadn't been alone with each other in 2 months. He'd have no problem with a pretty girl's hand on his ass. The intercom cracked to life. Prepare for... The pilot never got the words out. The plane tilted, nose down, like it was arcing over the peak of a roller coaster. The woman with the black hair felt her stomach twist. All that was left was the final drop. Suddenly there were anvils on her shoulders, pressing her into her seat. Diagonally across the aisle, an army lieutenant with buzzed red hair and triangular eyes made a face and gripped his armrests, just beginning to realize how bad it was about to get. The woman with the black hair was army too, a 27-year-old supply sergeant, and on those first days of her airborne training at Fort Benning, they taught her that when it comes to a plane crash, people don't panic. They become docile and silent. To save yourself, you need to take action. The plane jolted, nearly knocking the pen from her hand. The pen. Her letter. She almost forgot she was writing it. She thought about Anthony. About writing a will. Then she replayed those last few minutes before she got on board. Oh, God. Now it made sense. Her stomach was up in her throat. The VIPs at the front of the plane were now screaming. She knew why this plane was going down. This wasn't an accident. Frantically, she jotted a new note, her hand shaking, tears squeezing out from behind her eyes. The plane jolted again. A fireball of jet fuel came in through the emergency door on her left from outside. Her shirt was on fire. She patted it out. She could smell melting plastic, yet at the sight of the flames, the door. She was seated at the emergency exit. Still clutching tight to the scribbled note, she gripped the door's red handle with both hands and started to pull. It gave way and she slid it sideways. There was a pop. The door was still closed, but the seal was broken. 20 seconds to go. She tried to get out of her seat, but her seatbelt, it was still buckled. In a frenzy, she clawed at it. Click. She was free. Still holding the crumpled note, now damp in her sweaty fist, she put her palm to the exit door and gave it a shove. It was stuck from the fire. She gave it a kick. The door opened as a rodeo of wind whipped her black hair in every direction. Papers went flying through the cabin. A phone bounced against the ceiling. People were screaming, though she couldn't make out any of it. 14 seconds to go. Outside, the tall, snow-covered aspen trees that had looked so small were now racing at her, growing larger every second. She knew the odds. When you free-fall in a light aircraft, if fate's not on your side, you don't have a chance.
Go! Get out!
A man's voice shouted. She had barely turned as the lieutenant with the triangular eyes barreled into her, fighting to get to the emergency exit. The plane was in free-fall now, a reddish-orange smoke filling the cabin. 11 seconds to go. The man was pushing against her with all his weight. They both knew if they jumped too soon, above 300 feet, they wouldn't survive the impact. Even if they were lucky enough to live, the compound fractures in their legs, if the bones came through their skin, it'd make them bleed out in no time. No. This had to be timed just right. Not until you're at the treetops, she told herself, remembering her training and eyeing the aspens, which were closer than ever. The wind blinded her. The smoke was in her lungs as she held the lieutenant at bay with one hand and held tight to the note with her other.
Go! Now!
The man screamed, and for a moment it looked like his back was on fire. 8 seconds to go. The plane plummeted diagonally toward the ground. Without even thinking about it, she stuffed the note into the one place she thought it might survive.
We don't have...
6 seconds. She put her foot on the lip of the doorway, turned back to the lieutenant and grabbed him by his shirt, trying to pull him outside with her. This could work. She could save them both. She was wrong. The lieutenant pulled away. It was instinct. No one wants to be yanked from a plane. That was the end. The lieutenant with the triangular eyes would go down, literally, in flames. With 3 seconds to go, the woman with the black hair leapt from the plane. She would land on the balls of her feet, still trying to follow her training as she hit with a thud in the snow. A perfect landing, but also a deadly one. She'd break both legs and snap her neck on impact. The emergency crews would find her name on the manifest. Nola Brown. And the scribbled note, her final words that she'd hidden so well, that would be found by the least likely person of all.
1. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. Jim Zig Zigarowski knew the pain was coming. It didn't stop him. He was good with pain, used to it. Still, he knew this one would sting. Since the day Zig arrived at this remote building at the back of Dover Air Force Base, every case was wrenching. Especially this one. Hence, the pain. "I thought Lou was on call today," asked Dr. Womack, a short Hispanic man with a weak beard and baggy medical scrubs. "We switched," Zig said, wheeling the gurney a bit faster up the hallway, hoping to leave Womack behind. "Lou had a dinner date." "Really? I just saw Lou at dinner. All alone." Zig stopped. This was the moment where it could all implode. Zig shouldn't be here. Shouldn't have taken this gurney, or what was hidden below the light blue sheet that covered it. Would Womack stop him? Only if he realized what was going on. "Huh. Guess I heard it wrong," Zig said, flashing the same charming grin that made those first years after his divorce so eventful. With mossy green eyes, a hairline scar on his jaw, and silver and black hair cut like Cary Grant's, Zig didn't look 52. But as he swiped his ID card and the metal double doors popped open, leading to the heart of the military installation, he was feeling it. A sign above the door read, "Danger, formaldehyde, irritant, and potential cancer hazard." Womack paused, turning away. Zig grinned, picked up speed, and gave a hard push to the gurney that was draped with a light blue sheet, covering the corpse underneath. In between the corpse's legs, pinning the sheet down, was a 1-pound silver bucket. The gut bucket, they called it, because after the autopsy, it held all the internal organs. As Zig would tell new cadets, no matter how fat, thin, tall, or short you are, for every single one of us, all our organs fit in a 1-pound bucket. For Zig, it was usually reassuring to know we all have that in common. Though right now, it wasn't bringing the reassurance he needed. Automatic lights blinked on, lighting the medical suite. With a pneumatic hiss, the double doors bit shut behind him. For well over a decade, Zig had spent his days working in this high-tech surgical room, which served as a mortuary for the U.S. government's most top-secret and high-profile cases. On 9/11, the victims of the Pentagon attack were brought here. So were the victims of the attack on the USS Cole, the astronauts from the space shuttle Columbia, and the remains of well over 50,000 soldiers and CIA operatives who fought in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and every secret location in between. Here, in Delaware, of all places, at Dover Air Force Base, was America's most important funeral home. Be quick, Zig told himself, though when it came to preparing our fallen heroes for burial, Zig was never quick. Not until the job was done. Readjusting his own blue medical scrubs, Zig could feel the pain inching even closer. On the head of the gurney, he reread the name scrawled on a jagged strip of masking tape. Sergeant First Class Nola Brown. Welcome home, Nola, he whispered. The corpse swayed slightly as he locked the wheels on the gurney. Sometimes at Dover, an incoming dead soldier would have your same birthday, or even your same name. Last year, a young Marine with the last name Zigarowski died of smoke inhalation at a base in Kosovo. Naturally, Zig grabbed that case. Nola, named for New Orleans, Louisiana, was different. It's been a while, hasn't it? Zig asked the shrouded body. Lowering his head, he said a quick prayer, the same prayer he said in every case. Please give me strength to take care of the fallen so their family can begin healing. Zig knew too well how grieving families would need that strength. On his left, on a medical rolling cart, were his tools in size order, from largest forceps to smallest scalpel. Zig reached for the blue plastic eye caps, which looked like contact lenses with small spikes on them. Zig generally was not a superstitious man, but he was superstitious about the eyes of the dead, which never close as easily as the movies would have you believe. When you look at a corpse, the corpse looks back. The eye caps were a mortician's trick for keeping a client's eyes shut. How could he possibly have let another mortician work this case? Nola Brown wasn't a stranger. He knew this girl, even if she wasn't a girl anymore. She was 26. Even from her outline under the sheet, he could see it. Strong, and built like a soldier. Zig knew her from Pennsylvania, back when she was 12. She was friends, a fellow Girl Scout, with Zig's daughter Maggie. Magpie. His little star, Zig thought, reliving those easy days before everything went so bad. There it was. The pain that now made his bones feel like they were hollowed out, simple to snap. Had Zig known Nola well? He remembered that night back at the Girl Scout campout. Zig was a chaperone, Nola the new girl. Adopted. Naturally, the other girls seized on that. But it was more than that. Some girls are quiet. Nola was silent. Silent Nola. A few of the girls thought that made Nola tough. But Zig knew better. Sometimes silence is beaten into people. When you looked Nola's way, her black eyes with flecks of gold would beg you not to engage. Zig had been warned. Silent Nola was already on her fourth school. Expelled from the other three for fighting, one girl said. Knocked out someone's front teeth with the blunt end of a Yoo-hoo bottle. Another of Magpie's friends said she was caught stealing, too. But come on. Ever since the Salem witch trials, groups of 12-year-old girls couldn't be trusted. You really took a beating that night, didn't you? Zig asked Nola's corpse as he grabbed the outdated iPod that sat in a sound dock on a nearby shelf. With a few clicks, Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell was playing from the cheap speaker. Even morticians needed working music. I owe you forever for what you did that night, Zig sighed. To this day, Zig still didn't know who threw the can of orange soda into the campfire, or how long it was there. He could still see the campfire's smoke blowing sideways. For a moment, There was a high-pitched whistle, like a shrieking teapot. Then out of nowhere, a loud pop like a cherry bomb. Hunks of aluminum exploded in every direction. Most of the girls screamed, then laughed. Maggie's instinct was to freeze. Silent Nola's instinct was to jump sideways. Nola slammed into Maggie, who was standing there, frozen in fear as shards of razor-sharp metal flew at Zig's daughter's face. At the impact, Maggie crashed to the dirt, completely safe. Still in mid-fall, Silent Nola let out a yelp, a screech like an injured dog, then held the side of her head, blood everywhere. The metal can had sliced away a chunk of her ear. The smoke was still blowing sideways. To this day, Zig didn't know if Nola did it purposefully, tackling his daughter to protect her, or if it was just dumb luck, the fortunate result of Nola's flight reflex. All he knew for sure was, without Nola, his daughter would have taken that metal bomb in the face. Everyone agreed. On that night, Nola had saved Zig's daughter. Before anyone could react, Zig had scooped Nola up and drove her to the nearest emergency room. Maggie sat next to Nola in the back seat, thanking her for what she did, and also looking at her dad in a whole new way. For those few moments, on the way to the hospital, Nola, and Zig for scooping her up, were heroes. "Thank you," his daughter kept saying to Nola. "Thank you for what... You okay?" Nola never answered. She sat there, knees to her chest, eyes down as she gripped her ear. No doubt she was in pain. The top of her ear was gone. Tears ran down her cheeks, but she never made a sound. Silent Nola had learned to take it in quiet. At the hospital, as the doctor got ready to stitch her up, a nurse told Nola to hold tight to Zig's hand. Nola shook her head. 3 hours and 40 stitches later, Nola's adoptive father stormed into the emergency room, smelling of bourbon and the breath mints to cover it. The first words out of his mouth were, "The Girl Scouts better be paying for this." As Nola left the hospital that night, head down and shuffling her feet as she trailed meekly behind her dad, Zig wanted to say something, wanted to thank this girl, but more than that, wanted to help this girl. He never did. Of course, Zig and Maggie brought a huge gift basket to Nola's house. Nola's adoptive dad opened the door, grabbed it from Maggie's hands, and grunted a thanks. Zig kept at it, making calls to see how Nola was doing. One night he even stopped by to check in on her. He never got a response. Undeterred, Zig nominated her for one of the big Girl Scout honors. Nola missed the ceremony. A year later, Zig had the very worst night of his life. It took his marriage, his life, and most important, it took his daughter, his magpie. Nola had saved her on the night of the campfire, but all Maggie got was another 11 months. Zig would forever blame himself for all of it. Though Zig did not know it at the time, Nola had moved on to her fifth school. Zig never saw her again. Until tonight. "Don't you worry, Nola. You're in good hands now," Zig promised as he gripped the surgical sheet in one hand and the eye caps in the other. "And thank you again for what you did." In the mortuary at Dover, some say they do the job because they see their own children in the lives of these dead soldiers. Zig shook his head at maudlin explanations like that. He did this job for one reason. He was good at it. This was the gift God gave him. He saw every dead body as a puzzle, and no matter how bad the wounds, he could put each body back together so the family could say a proper goodbye. He did it day after day, soldier after soldier, over 2,000 of them by now. And none of them had made him see those darkest days with his own daughter. Until tonight, when he saw the woman who saved her. As he rolled the sheet down to Nola's neck and slid the eye caps into place, shutting her eyes, his throat tightened like it was gripped by a fist. This was the pain he was dreading, even when you're ready for it. Nothing sneaks up on you like grief. Nola's head was turned sideways, her left cheek flash burned from the plane crash that killed her. Fallen, number 2356. You have my word, Nola. We'll get you looking great in no time, Sig told her, fighting to keep his voice steady, even as he calculated how much makeup this one would take. He should have never grabbed this case. He should ask one of his fellow morticians to switch right now. But he wouldn't. Since the moment he first saw Nola's name on Dover's official big board, Zig couldn't stop thinking about that night at the campfire. Couldn't stop seeing Nola crashing into young Maggie, knocking her out of the way. Couldn't stop seeing the smoke blowing sideways, or Nola's mangled left ear. And couldn't stop replaying that look in his daughter's eyes when she saw Zig as a hero. Today, Zig knew his daughter was wrong. Even back then, he wasn't a hero. He wasn't even a good person. But damn, it felt good to be a dad again. Or at least to play the role of dad again. One last mother trucker. Zig glanced down at Nola's left ear. It was charred, but otherwise perfect. Not a piece missing. How could that? He looked again. Her entire ear was there. There wasn't even the hint of a scar. He leaned closer to make sure. Could he have remembered it wrong? Maybe it was the other ear. Gently, he turned Nola's head, face up, her cold skin like a glass of ice water. On the right half of her face, her skin was perfect, not burned at all. According to the casualty report, her military plane crashed just after takeoff, outside of Copper Center, Alaska, on the edge of the national park. All 7 people aboard, including the pilot, were killed. Nola was considered the lucky one, thrown clear of the plane. Or maybe she jumped, considering the compound fractures in her legs. Definitely a jump, Zig thought, recalling Nola's instincts at the campfire. Since she landed in the snow, with the right side of her face in the slush, the ice protected her from the gruesome burns she would have suffered all over her body as the plane went up in flames. There you go. Turn just like that, Zig whispered as he rotated Nola's head all the way and got his first good view of... Look at that. Nola's other ear was perfect, too. 2 pristine ears. No pieces missing. No scars. It made no sense. Zig looked back down at Nola's face, at her closed eyes. He hadn't seen her since she was 12. Was her nose flat like that? Could she have had her ears repaired? Absolutely. But as Zig knew firsthand, ears are difficult to rebuild, and however great the surgeon who did it, they always showed a hairline scar. Zig stepped down to the foot of the table, rechecking the laminated barcode around Nola's ankle, matching it to the ones on the gurney itself. The mortuary at Dover is considered one of the military's true no-fail missions. The most important part of all its jobs is to make sure that one body is never mixed up with another. When fallen soldiers come into Dover, they don't even get to morticians like Zig until their identity has been triple-checked by DNA, then dental records, then fingerprints. Fingerprints. From under the surgical sheet, Zig reached for Nola's hands. Both were burned black. With charring this bad, they usually couldn't get fingerprints. But that didn't mean there weren't any. Racing out into the hallway toward the kitchenette in the break room, Zig grabbed a metal pot from one of the cabinets, filled it with water, and put it on the stove. As he waited for the water to boil, he pulled out his phone and dialed one of the few numbers he knew by heart. Area code 202, Washington, D.C. What do you want? A female voice asked. Thanks, Wags. So nice to hear your voice. Don't sweet talk. Spit it out. You want something. Just the same things I always want. True friendship. More 2-in-1 restaurants, like when they combine Dunkin' Donuts with Baskin Robbins. Oh, and an end to people who make you take off your shoes in their house. We need to band together and fight against those people. He could practically hear Wags rolling her eyes. This better be something for work, she said. Amy Wags wasn't stupid. As head of the FBI unit that pulled terrorists' biometrics from explosive devices, she was a specialist in what people leave behind. She was even left behind herself when her husband of 12 years decided he was gay and wanted her permission to date his law partner, Andrew. When it happened, Wags couldn't tell anyone at work. But she told Zig. "Let me know what you need," she said in exasperation. "Oh, jeez. You're one of those people who makes everyone take their shoes off, aren't you? Zig, if this isn't important, you're now the only thing holding me back from my date night with a reality show about a little dwarf family. Tell me what's going on." On the stove, wafts of steam rose from his pot of water. "I need you to run a fingerprint." "You got the fang?" she asked, referring to the FBI's best weapon. "I will in a minute," Zig said, leaving the boiling water behind and heading back into the hallway. It was late, after 7 p.m., in a military location. The building was a ghost town. Zig's surgical shoe covers whispered down the hallway as he headed toward the closed door of Wags's former office, the FBI's latent print unit, a section of the building for FBI employees only. "Is this for something personal? Or did Adrian okay it?" Wags asked. "What do you think?" "Zig, please don't tell me you're about to break into our office." "I'm not. I'm just checking to see if you have the same old password." "Yep, there it is. You really should update that code," he said as the door clicked open. "Zig, don't do this. You know you're not allowed in there." "And I'd never go in," Zig said, stepping inside. It was a small room, even by Dover standards. Single desk, standalone computer terminal, and a cabinet to hold evidence. Plus, one other tool. From the top drawer of the desk, Zig pulled out a black device that looked like a cell phone made with mil-spec hardware, meaning you could drop it and it wouldn't break. Zig didn't plan on dropping it. The fang cost more than his annual salary. "Are you even listening?" Wags shouted through the phone as Zig darted back to the break room. "If Adrian hears that you took that without his permission..." "I have permission. I'm talking to you, aren't I?" "Don't do that. It's not funny." "I'm not trying to be funny. Funny is when I'm reminiscing about 2-in-1 restaurants." "Zig, how long do I know you? If you're making jokes, especially weak ones like this..." "Hold on. Did you say weak? Are you in trouble? Tell me what's going on." Grabbing the pot of boiling water from the stove, Zig didn't answer. He raced back to Nola's body. "Does the body at least have good prints to give?" Wags added. "Absolutely," Zig lied, swiping his ID, waiting for the lab doors to click, and once again approaching the gurney. From afar, even with the gut bucket between her legs, Nola almost looked like she was sleeping. But a dead body always lies differently. There's a permanence that's unmistakable. At Nola's side, Zig grabbed her lifeless hand, scraped some of the black charring from her fingers, then held her hand over the pot of boiling water. "Nola, I'm sorry for this," he whispered as he dunked her hand in the hot water. He had to do this part right. No more than a few seconds. When hands get badly burned, the ridges of the epidermis become black and unreadable. But like a burnt steak, if you scrape the charring away, there's a pink layer underneath. The dermal layer. The only problem is, the dermal ridges are too flat to give a proper fingerprint. But as any medical examiner, or mortician, knows, if you dip that finger in boiling water for 7 seconds, the ridges will plump up. Sure enough, as Zig pulled Nola's hand from the steaming water, her pointer and middle fingers were thick and swollen. "Turning on the fang," Zig said as he hit a few buttons. The fang got its name from the two green lasers that pointed out from the bottom of the device. Lining up the lasers with Nola's pointer finger, Zig hit another button, activating the scanner. "Work, email, or home?" Zig asked. "This official business or not?" "Home it is," Zig said, hitting send. Through the phone, there was a musical ping. Fingerprint delivered. It'd take only a few minutes for Wags to check the FBI database. "What's the story with this soldier? Why the personal interest?" Wags asked, already clicking on her keyboard. It's just a case, Sig said. According to the ID here, she's Sergeant First Class Nola Brown, female, 26 years old. And that's all you know about her? What else is there to know? It's just a case, Sig insisted, his voice unwavering. Siggy, I love you. But do you have any idea why, when the corpses come in, you're the one who gets all the facial injuries? What are you talking about? Don't play modest. If a soldier gets shot in the chest, they get assigned to any mortician. But when someone takes 3 bullets to the face, why does that body always go to you? Because I can sculpt. I'm good with the clay. It's more than talent. Last year, when that Marine was hit by ISIS rocket fire, every other mortician said it should be a closed casket, that you should wrap him in gauze. You were the only one stubborn enough to spend 14 straight hours wiring together his shattered jaw, then smoothing it over with clay and makeup, just so you could give his parents far more ease than they ever should have expected at their son's funeral. But you know what that makes you? Someone who's proud to serve his country. I love my country, too. I'm talking about your job, Zig. When you take these horrors, lost hands, lost faces, lost lips, and you make them more palatable, you know what that makes you? Before Zig could answer, Wags blurted, a master liar. That's what every mortician sells, Zig. Lies. You do it for the right reasons. You're trying to help people through their hardest times. But every day, to hide those horrors, you need to be a first-class liar. And you're getting far too good at it. Zig went to say something, but nothing came out. Closing his eyes, he turned back to the body. There was a chime through the phone. Wags had something. Okay, I found Nola Brown. 26 years old, Wags said. Same age as Maggie, isn't she? At just the mention of his daughter's name, Zig spun toward the body, moving so fast and so off balance, his elbow clipped the silver bucket that was filled with... No, no, no! The gut bucket! Zig lunged. The bucket, with its gruesome stew, began to tip. Zig was still reaching for it, still holding tight to his phone as he started to yell. The bucket continued to tip, its contents sliding toward the lip. There was a loud, wet splat. For 2 decades, Zig had become accustomed to the gore that accompanied death. But as he looked down at the mess across the shiny gray floor, something caught his eye. Ziggy? We have a problem, Wags said in his ear. Zig barely heard her, focusing on the gray mass that he recognized as the stomach. Something wasn't right. There was a round lump, like when a snake swallows a rat. He leaned closer, making sure he was seeing it right. He was. There was something inside. Ziggy? You there? Wags asked as Zig put the phone on speaker and set it down on the gurney. He moved even closer. Whatever was inside, it wasn't round or smooth. It was jagged and poking at the inner wall like a crumpled piece of paper. Zig's mouth went dry. He'd seen this before. During 9/11, one of the victims on the Pentagon flight knew the end was coming, and was smart enough to know that if you're ever in a plane crash, the best way to leave a note to your loved ones is to write it down and swallow the paper. The liquids in your stomach and intestines can protect the paper, since those are the last parts of your body that burn. Back then, Zig found the note in the victim's intestine. He cut it open with a scalpel, then tweezed his fingers inside. It was perfectly preserved. For fallen number 227, a final private goodbye. Who, hearing me? I found the fingerprints, Wags shouted. Zig still didn't answer. Grabbing a scalpel from his workstation and readjusting his medical gloves, he got down on one knee and sliced, making the hole big enough to... There. Zig pulled out the crumpled piece of paper. It was squished and soggy, easy for a medical examiner to miss, but otherwise intact. Slowly peeling it open and being careful not to rip it, he could see the thin gray pencil lines, with frantic, shaky letters, the ultimate message in the ultimate bottle. Zig, are you listening? I ran the prints. That body you're looking at, whoever she is, that's not Nola Brown. Zig nodded to himself, his mouth sagging open as he read and reread the handwritten note, the dying words of the female stranger lying on the table in front of him. Nola, you were right. Keep running. 2. Naperville, Illinois. For 5 hours, Day One Yamaguchi had been staring at his laptop screen. There were worse jobs, especially for a 24-year-old who'd been arrested twice for forgery and computer trespass. He could be like his pal Zork, who used to hack credit card numbers from an auto parts chain, until he was caught by the feds and threatened with 30 years in prison. Today, Zork was a $40,000-a-year employee for the U.S. government. A few of Day One's other friends took their talents, and a bit more money, to work for Syria and Iran. And still others honed their skills at local hacking conventions, though Day One knew that most of those were government fronts designed to sniff out local prospects. This wasn't the go-go early 2000s anymore. These days, most hacking was state-sponsored, but not all of it. Sucking on a peanut M&M and letting the candy coating melt away, Day One settled in for his 6th hour staring at the screen. It was the ultimate irony. Hackers get into hacking because they don't want desk jobs. But all hacking is a desk job. By hour 7, Day One was still sitting there, staring. Same at hour 8. And hour 9. Then, ping. There it was, on screen. Picking up his phone, Day One dialed the number they made him learn by heart. Talk. A man with a wood chipper of a voice answered. This was what they lied about. The worst part of the job wasn't staring at a screen. It was dealing with him. He never gave a name. That didn't stop Day One from looking for it. But what unnerved Day One was that he couldn't find it. And Day One could find anything. Talk, the man insisted. The site you asked me to watch. You said to call you when someone pinged it. Someone pinged it. Who? A woman. Amy Wags, Day One replied, clicking through a few screens. She's FBI, just like you said. Went straight for the Nola Brown file. The man went silent. Is Ms. Wags looking for herself or someone else? Checking, Day One replied, tossing back another peanut M&M as a new screen loaded. From what I can tell, she's on her phone right now. I'm trying to see who she's talking to. You're telling me you can hack into an FBI agent's phone? Only when they're dumb enough to use their personal one instead of a secure line. Swear to Steve Jobs, whoever invented working from home should get a big wet kiss on the mouth. The man with the wood chipper voice didn't say a word. Okay, here we go, Day One eventually said, leaning closer to the screen. 302 phone number. Delaware. Truthfully, I didn't think they allowed anyone to live in Delaware anymore. The man still didn't answer. Jim Zigarowski. That's who she's talking to, Day One added. Says he's employed at the Doverport Mortuary, whatever that is. There was a long silence on the other line. Zig, the man finally whispered. That's a name I haven't heard in a while. 3. Dover, Delaware. It was nearly midnight as Zig rang the doorbell of the split-level home. Of course there was no answer. Come on, Guns, don't do this tonight, Zig called out, hopping in place to stay warm. The door still didn't open. Zig rang the bell again out of spite, then followed the overgrown lawn to his left, toward the garage. On cue, a chunk and a loud whir sent the garage door rolling upward. Slapshot, a muscular black man called from inside, swiping a hockey stick as he faced the back wall of the garage. With a punishing swing that nearly knocked the glasses from his face, The man swatted an orange puck into a net. From there, on a flat-screen TV attached to the garage's back wall, a video game hockey puck continued to fly, following the initial trajectory and going far wide of the computerized Russian goalie guarding the net. "Why does Lake Placid hate me so much?" Marine Corps Master Gunnery Sergeant Francis Storenko asked. "Weak players blame the field," Sig said. "It's not a field. It's a rink. It's a television. Now you want to hand me the twig?" Sig asked, reaching for the hockey stick. "I'm still 3 shots down from our last game. My manhood's on the line." It wasn't Zig's best joke, but he'd known Master Guns for over a decade. They'd worked hundreds of cases, buried thousands of soldiers, and fought to stay sane in this very garage by drinking gallons of Master Guns's homemade gin while playing drunk video game hockey, almost always against the Russians. The joke should have earned Zig a chuckle, or at the very least a cheap crack about his manhood. Instead, Master Guns held tight to the hockey stick, facing the TV screen on the wall. "Ziggy, I know you're not here to play hockey." Master Guns never took long to reveal he was Dover's chief homicide investigator. "You're wearing the scent," Master Guns said, his beefy military build practically bursting through his t-shirt and sweatpants. "I smell it from here." Sometimes Zig forgot how sharp his friend was. Humans have a unique odor. For the dead, it was even more unmistakable. A mix of sweetness and rotting fish that dogs can smell for up to 14 months after someone's killed. Zig had taken 3 showers before coming here, thinking the scent of death had been scrubbed away. Most people would be fooled. Master Guns had never been most people. "This is about the woman in the plane crash, isn't it?" he asked. "Nola Brown." Zig stayed silent as a burst of wind sliced through the garage. The place was decorated like a bachelor pad, complete with a cheap black leather sofa that sagged in the middle. The wind sent the hockey net swaying and lifted the pages of magazines on the glass coffee table. Zig eyed the door that led into Master Guns's house. This was a conversation that was better conducted inside. But Zig knew he'd never get there. It was Master Guns's one rule. No one goes inside the house. Garage only. No exceptions. Master Guns might be Zig's closest work friend, but the emphasis had always been on the word work. They'd had barbecues in this garage, blown out birthday cakes, and even on a winter night as cold as tonight, toasted Guns's dead brother-in-law, a fallen Marine whom Master Guns asked Zig to work on personally. With work like that, the only way to stay sane was to keep your work life separate from your home life. The door between the garage and the rest of the house was his dividing line. "How do you know this was about Nola?" Zig asked.
"Ziggy, it's midnight. On a weekday. Do I look like one of your girlfriends?"
"What's that mean?"
"Come on now. Melinda in legal has a crush on you. She's smart, good-looking, even age-appropriate, but you don't date her. Sherry in case management has been divorced for a year. Same thing, same age as you, and you don't date her. And Esther in veteran affairs looks like Mrs. Howell from Gilligan's Island, if she were still alive today. All I'm saying, lovey, is that your last girlfriend, the sales rep for that energy drink company, how long did she stick around? 3 weeks? A month? I know why you do it, Ziggy. Life is much easier if you surround yourself with people who will leave you. But don't tell me you're coming here to play hockey, then think you can slyly pump me for information without me knowing." As he turned, Zig could finally read what was written on Master Guns's Marine's t-shirt. "My job is to save your ass, not kiss it." "The t-shirt's kinda heavy-handed, even for you," Zig said. "Don't screw with me, Ziggy," Master Guns said as the big vein swelled in his neck. "Tell me why you're so interested in this Nola Brown case." When Zig didn't answer, Master Guns used the heel of his palm to pound a button on the wall. The garage door whirred, slowly rolling downward. Time for some privacy. Ziggy. I know her, Ziggy blurted. Nola Brown. She's from Ekron. I knew her when she was little. She saved Maggie's life. Ah, there's the reason. You're damn right that's the reason. What she did that night. For me and for Maggie. I need to pay that back. And I'm telling you, that body in the mortuary? That's not her. For the next few minutes, Sig laid out the rest. About what she did at the campfire. The piece that was missing from the real Nola's ear. The swallowed note. And how this made him think Nola was still alive and in danger. With each new detail, Master Guns took a slow breath through his nose. It was an old investigator trick. The calmer he made you feel, the more he thought you'd talk. But Zig saw the way that Master Guns's caterpillar eyebrows were starting to knit together. Master Guns looked annoyed. He looked disturbed. But he didn't look the least bit surprised. You knew this already, didn't you? Zig asked. That there was a secret note hidden in her body? How could I possibly know something like that? That wasn't what I asked, Guns. Bodies don't get to me until DNA, dental, and fingerprints have been checked and verified. That means someone from the FBI did the match. But when I asked my friend in the bureau, she pulled up their work board. Guess what she found? The FBI still hasn't sent a fingerprint expert. Make your point. My point is, without that expert, the only way for this body to get to me in the mortuary was if someone high up, like our colonel, or say, our chief investigator, signed off on it. Now come on. Tell me what you're not saying. Master Guns was a decorated Marine. Zig was a civilian mortician with a knack for rebuilding dead bodies. To most, their difference in rank would be an issue. But for Master Guns, the only rank that mattered was this. Heart or no heart. They saw it every day. Do you believe in the mission of dealing with our fallen troops with honor, dignity, and respect? Or are you someone who, when you hear that a new body is coming in, looks at your watch to see if you can sneak out before the shift change? No question, Master Guns had heart. Zig? Master Guns knew the answer to that. Everyone knew the answer. Ziggy, in the autopsy report, did you see how Nola died? I told you. I don't think it's Nola. I heard you. Whoever she is, did you read how she died? Plane crash, in Alaska. That's right. And have you seen the coverage on the news? I've been working on the body. Why? What are they saying? That's the thing. They're saying nothing. And I mean nothing. Every other plane crash, no matter how far it is, the French Alps, Malaysia, wherever, the whole world knows the instant the plane goes down. But this 7-person flight Nola was on, it plummeted 48 hours ago, and the news is just now hitting the airwaves. You know what it takes to pull off 2 days of silence? Even we didn't hear about it until the body was on its way. Okay. So the same thing happened a couple years back when Senator Uss's plane went down with those CIA folks aboard. Whenever the secret squirrels get involved, we only get a few hours' notice. You're not listening. When Nola's body arrived, 2 men in crappy black suits were waiting in my office with Colonel Sue. They flashed IDs and politely told me that they had a special interest in this case. They also said they wanted the body the moment we were done with it, as in immediately. So they're the ones who gave you Nola's fingerprints? Forget the prints. The last time black suits showed up like that, 2 buildings had gone down in New York, and we were scrambling to identify victims from the Pentagon crash. When Zig closed his eyes, he still saw it so clearly. In the hours after 9/11, As the Pentagon victims started arriving, Zig was unpacking the burned body of a dark-skinned man with a missing arm. Out of nowhere, two FBI agents were standing over Zig's shoulder, watching a bit too intently. Zig quickly realized he wasn't working on one of the victims. He had the pilot, one of the terrorists. Soon after, the FBI whisked the body away for their own private testing. "You think Nola, or whoever she really is the one who crashed the plane?" Zig asked. "I don't care if she did. What worries me more is who we're picking a fight with." "We?" Zig asked hopefully. "You," Master Guns clarified in deep baritone. "The black suits. Whatever they're looking at, this is far beyond the world where you and I live. Our job is to bring closure, not open up more problems."
"Closure doesn't exist. Not for anyone."
"No. Nuh-uh. Now you're getting emotional, and when you get emotional, you get stupid."
"Some things are worth being stupid over."
"Not this," Master Guns growled, pointing the hockey stick like a magician's wand. On most nights, a threat from Master Guns might make Zig back off. But tonight, Zig wasn't intimidated or daunted in any way. No. Since the moment he realized Nola was still out there, Zig was... he didn't have a word for it yet, but he could feel it. A need. He needed to know what happened to Nola. Needed to find out if she was safe. But also, something else. Something that was tugging at him from his core, and lighting it up, like a spark igniting a dormant fire. He needed to find the answer to this case. But he also needed the case itself. "You think you're just searching for an old friend of your daughter. She's more than a friend. She saved Maggie's life. So now you have to save this girl's life? You're making a karmic trade? You don't understand. We knew her. The whole community knew her. She gave me an extra year with my daughter. Which is absolutely commendable. I understand your need to do right by her. But you're sticking your head in a fire here, Ziggy. And not a little campfire that singes your ear. This'll burn you alive. Just like her. So I should just ignore that Nola's out there? That she might need help? Even forgetting that I know her? This body in our morgue, whoever she really is, that's someone's kid. Someone raised her, combed her hair, took pictures of her every year on her first day of school. And now we're supposed to do nothing even though we know she's misidentified?" Guns didn't answer. He didn't have to. During their first weeks at Dover, Master Guns and Zig found out that one of their supervisors was sending unidentified remains, random bones, fingers, even someone's leg, to be dumped in a nearby landfill, just to clean house. The remains were old, impossible to ID, and taking up precious storage space. Master Guns and Zig were newbies, expected to go along and stay silent. Why rock the boat and risk your job and your career in the military? Because that's not how you honor our fallen brothers and sisters. The next day, they filed a report with the colonel. Their supervisor voluntarily retired soon after. "I'm happy to do this alone," Zig said. "You are doing this alone," Master Guns shot back, still pointing with the hockey stick. "They really put the spook in you, didn't they?" Zig asked. "Not they. Him." Zig cocked an eyebrow. Lost. "You don't even know who you're taking on, do you?" Master Guns asked, reaching for the TV remote. With the flick of a button, the video game was gone, replaced by CNN. The grisly image on screen glowed on the wall, lighting the dark garage. "It's all over the news. Nola's plane," Master Guns explained as the camera pulled in on footage of a small plane mangled in the snow. Smoke twirled in the air, but the plane looked mostly intact. Behind them, the garage door was still closed. But to Zig, it was suddenly colder than ever.
Didn't you see who else was on that flight?
4. Zig was home within the hour. His doormat sat askew on his front porch. Cursing the UPS guy, he kicked the mat back into place, opened the front door, and headed for the kitchen. From his left pocket, he pulled out a lunch receipt and a loose Post-it, dumping them both in the trash. From his right, he took out his pocket knife, a small 6-inch ruler, and his wallet, a lean stack of cash, credit cards, and driver's license, all bound by a thick red rubber band. Zig didn't carry any photos or memorabilia. Working every day with death, he was keenly aware. You can't take anything with you. Last year he read that highly hyped book that said to find true happiness, you should pare down your life, throw away everything you don't regularly use, and save only the things that bring you joy. For Zig, that joy came from chisels and carving tools, along with the drill press and battered workbench in the extra bedroom upstairs that he'd converted into a shop. It also came from taking care of his girls. With a beer in his hand, he headed out to his small backyard, where up on concrete blocks, there was a white wooden box that he'd built himself, with conspicuous dovetail joints that were hand-cut with a backsaw and chisel. The box was the size of a 2-drawer file cabinet with a small circular hole cut into it. A red and yellow sign on the side read, "Caution, dangerous bees." The bees weren't dangerous, especially this hive, which had a wonderfully calm queen. But the sign kept the kids in the neighborhood away from the one thing that brought Zig more peace than anything else. "Evening, ladies," he called out, approaching the wooden box and its 40,000 inhabitants. Zig got his first beehive back in college for a hippie science class called Animals and Farming. Back then he rolled his eyes when it was his week to take care of the professor's hive. His classmates hated it too. Yet, for Zig, from that very first day, there was one thing that fascinated him. Every creature in the hive, every single honeybee had a purpose. A role it followed its entire life. Guard bees protected the hive. Nurse bees took care of the babies. And architect bees built the hive's hexagon structure, making it mathematically perfect in every way. There were even undertaker bees, who removed the dead from the hive and flew 100 yards to dispose of the bodies. It was a job Zig knew well. Certainly humans have purpose in their lives. But why were the bees so single-minded and committed to that purpose? It wasn't just for the good of the queen. It was for the good of each other, for their whole community. How could anyone not admire a beautiful world like that? "Everyone okay?" Zig asked, knowing the answer. This late and this cold, the hive was quiet. But as Zig approached, he pulled out his phone and flicked on the flashlight. Something seemed off. He put his ear to the box. No buzzing. He put his face closer to the round hole he'd carved carefully in the wood. The guard bees, who sat right inside, should have already flown out. Still, nothing. Zig stuffed his finger in his beer bottle, tapping the bottle lightly against the side of the wood. Ping, pong, ping. Sure enough, a few bees exited. And then there it was, a low-pitched hum that surrounded him, that embraced him, that soothed him when he needed it most. For the first 10 years of his daughter's life, Zig looked in on her every night, checking the rise and fall of Maggie's chest, checking to make sure she was breathing. The hum of the bees, in its own way, gave him that same feeling. Everything would be okay, even if, deep down, he knew it wouldn't. "Good night, girls," he said. Every fall, after the queen bee was impregnated, All the male bees were murdered by the female bees. Right now, every bee in the hive was a female. Also, thanks for stinging that freckly kid who threw a baseball at the hive. He's not getting free honey this year, he added. In every life, whatever you do, you either destroy or create. As a mortician, Zig saw destruction every day. Beekeeping was his own personal offset. You have no messages, the ancient robotic answering machine voice announced as Zig returned to the kitchen. Flipping open his laptop, he slid into the breakfast nook that had taken him nearly half a year to make, also with hand-cut dovetail joints. On screen, Facebook bloomed into view to the only page he went to. Her page. Charmaine Clark. Every day he'd tell himself not to look, but every day he'd be back. Charmaine's most recent status update was a photo, a close-up of a t-shirt that read, "What if the Hokey Pokey really is what it's all about?" 42 friends liked it, declaring it so funny. Someone else added, "You're hysterical." Like most things online, it was an absurd overstatement. Still, there was one singular nugget even Facebook tended to get right. On the left side of the screen. Status? Single. Outside, a lone honeybee bounced off the window, swirling in the moonlight. Guard bee, Zig thought, though could be a forager. Back when he set up his first hive, foragers were Zig's favorites. They were the only ones to actually leave the hive, the ones on the grand adventure. Lately, though, Zig realized there was a reason why foraging was saved for the eldest bees in the hive. It would be the last job they had. They'd literally work themselves to death, dying alone. Suddenly, Zig's cell phone rang. Caller ID told him not to take it. "What's wrong?" he answered. "Nice to hear your voice, too," Wags pushed back, her work number showing she was still at the FBI. "Can't I just call to see how you're doing, and then you ask how I'm doing? That's how friendships work." Zig pretended to laugh. "How are you doing, Wags? How's Vincent?" he added, referring to Wags's son. "Too handsome for his own good. Thinks that just because he's 24 years old and starting a new job, selling timeshares for God's sakes, that he's too busy to call his frightfully underappreciated mother who he owes everything to. Oh, and my brother asked to borrow money again. So, yeah, same crappiness as usual. How about you? That Nola Brown case. It shook you up, didn't it?" "I appreciate you checking in, but I'm fine." "You sound mopey." "I'm great. Just got home," Zig said, turning back to his computer screen. "Status? Single." "You're on Facebook, aren't you?" Wags challenged. Zig stared at the screen, trying not to see his own reflection. Nearly 2 decades ago, Wags started at Dover 2 days before he did. But all these years later, their bond wasn't just from a mutual moment in time. She always understood him and knew where his holes were. "I'm not on Facebook," he insisted. "You do realize Facebook tells you when your friends are online. I'm on it right now. I can see you there, Ziggy." He clicked to a new screen, hating himself for being such a cliche. "If you want, Ziggy, I can go through Charmaine's profile and send you all the bad photos of her, or maybe just the good ones, depending on what kind of night you want." Usually he'd laugh at that joke. Not tonight, especially after everything with Nola and the churned-up memories of what she did for Maggie. Zig thought of his own daughter numerous times every day. In fact, he purposely said her name out loud each morning, just to make sure she wouldn't be forgotten. But today, after seeing that body, now he was picturing the worst of those days. Back when he was standing at Magpie's closet, trying to decide what dress they should bury her in. "Wags, it's late.
I've got to be at work early tomorrow.
You sure? I'm fine. You're a good friend. Thanks for checking in. Truthfully, I just wanted to bitch about my brother. But we can take it up tomorrow. Oh, and P.S. No one's life is as good as it looks on Facebook. As she hung up, Zig stared at the screen. Was he really that guy who spent his nights trolling online for the supposed love of his life? Zig didn't want to be that guy. He was done being that guy. Then again, he clicked back to Charmaine's profile. Maybe the hokey pokey really was what it's all about. In the Facebook search box, he typed the name Nola Brown. A few faces came up. None of them was the adult version of hers. Same with Google. He was tempted to call Wags back. But no, not yet. Nola, I know you're out there somewhere, Zig murmured. A few clicks of the keyboard took him over to CNN.com. Rook Sewell, six others, dead in Alaska crash. Plane crashes were tragic enough, but it was worse when the press lasered in on the biggest bold name on board and turned the rest of the passengers into asterisks. In this case, the bold name was Nelson Rookstuhl, the head of the Library of Congress. According to CNN, Rookstuhl was on a cross-country trip promoting literacy to rural Eskimo communities. Okay, that was his job. But as Master Guns had pointed out, the Librarian of Congress doesn't usually fly on military aircraft. At the end of the CNN story, it said the other victims' names were being withheld until families could be notified. Not true, Zig thought. The plane crashed 2 days ago. That was plenty of time to notify, which meant if they were still withholding IDs, it was to cover up whatever was really going on in Alaska. Clicking to a new screen, Zig logged into the mortuary's private intranet. The board, they called it, named after the enormous board in HQ that showed the names of all the incoming fallen soldiers and citizens who were headed Zig's way. According to the schedule, the remaining bodies from the Alaska crash would arrive first thing tomorrow, but as Zig scrolled down, he saw who else would be there to salute the flag-covered transfer cases that looked like caskets. Under incoming flights was the one call sign that always meant a bad day. M1. He stared at it, listening to the hum of his laptop, the hum of the bees outside. Marine 1. The big man himself was coming. The President of the United States. According to CNN, the President had appointed Rookstuhl to the librarian job. Apparently they were old friends. But for the President to be coming for this? Nola, what the hell do you get yourself into?
5. Guidry, Texas, 19 years ago. This was Nola when she was 7. She was a girl who noticed things. Even at that young age, she noticed the way her mom, Barb LaPointe, would check herself in the reflection of their shiny Home Depot kitchen faucet whenever she washed the dishes. She noticed how her dad, Walter, would move his lips, concentrating hard when reading the newspaper. Today, though, Nola didn't notice anything. She was too busy eating her favorite meal. Space Jam mac and cheese, chocolate milk, and Oreo cookies. Double stuff, of course. "Here you go, sweetie pie," Walter said. That should have been her first clue. She was never sweetie pie. Only his 3 biological kids were. Knocking the Oreo plate aside, Walter slid a vanilla icing sheet cake in front of her. For the rest of Nola's life, she'd remember the bright green letters. "We will miss you." Confused, Nola glanced around. Neither of her adopted parents would look her in the eye. "This will be your last night with the family," her dad, Walter LaPointe, said matter-of-factly.
What's going on? Why are you doing this?
But really,
Nola knew why they were doing this. A year and a half ago, Nola and her twin brother, Roddy, were rescued from a miserable group home in Arkansas. Barb LaPointe saw their photos on a fax and came to the house herself, expecting adorable twin three-year-olds. But Nola and her brother, with matching bowl haircuts so that predators wouldn't know Nola was a girl, were 3 years older than the group home had disclosed, with difficult behaviors carefully omitted. On her first night in Texas, Nola crouched in her bedroom closet, clutching the only belonging she'd brought from the group home, a stuffed pink elephant named Ellie. Her twin, Roddy, had matching black eyes with flecks of gold and the same honey-colored skin. But unlike somber Nola, he also came with a disarming grin, which made him more charming and likable, but also more dangerous. Within their first week with the LaPointes, the back window of the house was broken. Neighborhood kids, the parents assumed. Then toys started disappearing. When the toys were found, they smelled like urine. Soon, the LaPointes started worrying about the safety of their own young children, a worry amplified when someone lit the living room carpet on fire. Therapists were called, and things calmed down for a bit. But then Nola came home from school with a black eye and a hospital bill from a taunting boy in fifth grade whose front teeth she'd knocked out with a steel thermos. "Miss Nola," Walter said, lowering his voice, which only made her more uncomfortable. "It's time to go."
No,
she replied, tears pooling in her eyes.
"No, please don't do this."
Walter grabbed her arm.
"Please don't do this,"
she yelled, trying to pry herself from his grasp. At the top of the stairs, the other kids huddled together, staring down guiltily like they were trying to spy on Santa. At the back of the pack, no one could see her brother, Roddy, keeping his head down to hide the grin in his dark eyes. Nola wanted to scream,
"It was him! It was Roddy!"
who broke the window and peed on the toys. He was the one who picked the fight with thermos teeth. Roddy was about to get his ass kicked for telling the loud-mouthed boy that he'd masturbated in the boy's backpack, and Nola was just coming to his aid. True, Nola did set the carpet on fire, a hasty and poorly conceived plan to clear out the house to protect the family dog, whom Roddy was chasing with a candle. But at this point, would anyone even believe her? They would. In truth, the LaPointes knew all of this. Both twins had problems, but it was Roddy who needed the real help. Resources were tight. With three other kids to take care of, they could help one of the twins, but not both. Barb LaPointe prayed on it for a week. A decision was made. They would find Nola a new home. She was the stronger one. Naturally, it'd be tough on her, but she was resilient. She'd be okay.
"I'll be good. We'll both be good,"
Nola begged, bits of Oreo blacking out her teeth, crumbs spraying from her mouth.
"We'll be good!"
Da-da-ding-ding-ding-da-ding-ding. The doorbell rang. Back when Nola first came to live here, she loved that doorbell. It played the Yellow Rose of Texas, though she never knew the name of the song.
"No, please,"
Nola begged as Walter picked her up and carried her from the kitchen to the living room. Nola grabbed at the chairs, the phone cord, anything to get a handhold. Barb was sobbing as she followed behind them, prying Nola's grip from the threshold.
"Please, Mom! Don't give me to them! Don't give me to them!"
That's what Nola kept screaming over and over. "Don't give me to them." But it wasn't them. It was him. 3 weeks later, Nola stood silently in a cold, tiny Oklahoma kitchen. Her chin was down. It was always down, like it was stapled to her chest. Sometimes a posture of shyness, sometimes a posture of fear. Today it was a bit of both. Pretending to wash dishes, she was staring sideways, waiting to see his reaction to the steak. She knew her new dad, Royal Barker, a Catholic man with a pitted face, greedy eyes, and the longest eyelashes she'd ever seen, wouldn't say anything. He rarely said anything. But Royal was particular about his steaks, and even more particular about his favorite breakfast, steak and eggs.
"You treat every steak like a prom date," Royal told her during the first week after she moved in. "You take care of it, it'll take care of you."
It made no sense to Nola, but really neither did Royal. Why'd he even agree to take her in?
"I heard you can cook." "Can you cook?"
Royal had said on that night they left the LaPointes. It was the first thing he asked her when she got in the car. Actually, it was the second thing. The first was,
"You part nigger?"
Nola stayed silent, confused.
"You know, part nigger. Part dark black," he explained, pointing to her honey-colored skin.
Nola shook her head. She didn't think so, though she didn't have many memories before the group home. What happened to her birth mom? Why did she leave? Was she dead? On Nola's sixth birthday, a caseworker said that her mom had been murdered, but Nola knew that wasn't true. You'd feel such a thing.
"Too bad. I heard niggers cook better,"
Royal said, then quickly added,
"Your seatbelt on?"
It took 3 hours to reach Royal's house in Oklahoma. He showed Nola the kitchen first, then her bedroom, which had a mattress with pale blue sheets, a knotty pine dresser covered in Major League Baseball stickers, and bare walls. There were a few toys, G.I. Joes, a crusty Nerf football, even a half-dressed Barbie, scattered across the tan carpet like children had lived here before, though there were no signs of them now.